live from the Cultural Hall. This is the Mormon News Report for the week of December 4th, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
And hashtagging and respectfully sliding into your DMs with just a spoonful of snark. Brian, this is what the fellow kids are saying, so we're just trying to relate ourselves to the youth of today, you know?
Trying to get that hip language down.
Mm-hmm.
Today on the show, we're going to have Roseanne Benson. She's going to discuss her new book, Joseph Smith and Alexander Campbell, 19th Century Restorationists, which is co-published by BYU Press and Abilene Christian University. But first, oh man, Brant, boy, we really stepped in it last week, didn't we?
Okay, so there's we, and then there's me. So I don't know which one you're wanting to go with on that, but I'll just say this. I think that the best part about our listeners, and I mean this so sincerely, is the fact that they are passionate and they feel comfortable coming to us with their feedback, both positive and constructive, on the podcast. And I think that's the best part about our listeners. You what do you think, Brian?
Well, I mean, both of us got heat for different portions of it, but you know, we're gonna go through this. We're gonna work through this.
That's true.
This too shall pass, right?
Yeah, if we want to really get Mormon on everybody.
So we got a ton of letters and messages and social media, and we're going to try to read a few of those. Now, some of these letters and messages are pretty long, so we're going to have to read excerpts from them, and we tried our best not to take anything out of context. And then in a few minutes, we're actually going to invite Ryan McKnight and Ethan Dodge to come on because, well, Brant, you sort of called them out by name on our last episode, and I guess it's only fair that we let them respond on air.
Yeah, we did. So everyone, I just want you to know this is really a distinction that we want to make explicitly clear. Both Brian and I, we can't stand the internet tough guys. You know, the type of people who they only want to say things when it's safe and when they're behind a microphone. And we're both not above criticism. So both Ryan and Ethan are going to be coming on and they're going to talk about their Tribune op-ed that they did last week. So we did throw out a question last week and we got a few responses to those. We're going to get to those a little bit later in the show, mostly because we got a lot of news to cover this week. And we really want to get right into the feedback from last week's show. And frankly, Brian, we want to put this whole thing to bed.
So let's get into some of the letters that we got from last week's episode.
Okay, so let's do the first one. The first one was from Happy Hubby, who's written us quite a few times, and we appreciate that. He said, I really like the Mormon News Report podcast. I do feel you hit a good balance between all is perfect in Zion and the church is bad. I can find plenty of both extremes, but not much in that middle ground, which, Brian, that I take that as a compliment. I don't know about you.
Passionately in the middle.
That's right. It seems to me how most people use gaslighting. So we're going back to the gaslighting discussion we had last week. Most people use gaslighting to describe the act of attempting to tell someone you are wrong, everyone knows such and such. I see that repeated and consistent gaslighting will and can eventually result in someone feeling they are not able to trust their own judgment. The rant on the podcast seemed to feel that the gaslighting was only the result and not the individual acts that lead up to it. And that's a very valid point, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he makes a point. Colleen wrote, Brian stated, that's me, that gaslighting is the trendy term used by disaffected ex-Mormons, and I feel like this is the real issue here. The term itself is relatively recent, and it's definitely gaining popularity, but just because people are finally able to put a label on a phenomenon that they are experiencing does not make it an illegitimate use of the term. Brian's statement regarding ex-Mormons is where the real minimizing occurred. Yeah, I guess I'll take the heat. You acknowledge in the episode where the abuses are happening, you describe them, you define the term gaslighting, and then there is a disconnect when you say that it isn't fair for disaffected ex-Mormons to use the term. To claim the term can only be used by a psychologist is preposterous. Gaslighting is a term that defines an abuse tactic. Do you need to be a professional to describe abuses suffered by your loved ones? No, you don't. I feel like there's something deeper going on here and that this term has become a scapegoat for your frustration.
Brian, your response?
Wow. You know, I mean, Colleen, I totally get what you're saying. I don't think that I'm saying that disaffected ex-Mormons cannot use the term. I do agree with you that I think it's becoming a trendy statement within Mormonism and people are throwing it out without actually knowing what it means. So that's my biggest criticism. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like those the recent trend that people that guys had of like pompadouring their hair and putting a little like side part on the side. It's like once, you know, it was cool like in Portland when all the hipsters are doing it, but now like everybody's doing it. It's just not cool anymore. And that's more how I feel about the term gaslighting. Like everybody's using it as like their instant response instead of having a valid conversation about anything. It's just, you're gaslighting me. So that's where I stand on that.
And Brian, and I don't think this is putting words in your mouth. And I don't think I don't think either of us think that gaslighting is not a legitimate thing, that gaslighting doesn't exist. I think that what we're calling for is a little more calmness and a little more thought behind when we're using that word. Are we using it with the proper amount of, frankly, a power that it deserves? Because it does happen. And when it happens, it's horrible. But I just want people to take a step back a little bit and say, okay, when we're saying this, are we really conveying what it's supposed to mean? So here's what Adam Ellsworth wrote. Use of the term gaslighting is pure hyperbole and is symptomatic of critics' tendency to interpret everything church leaders say in the worst light possible. I appreciate you recognizing that there has been problems with transparency among church leaders in the past, and some leaders at all levels of leadership still choose to stay ignorant of church history and difficult questions, and also purvey that ignorance to those they serve. But I don't get that impression from Elder Ballard. As you mentioned in the podcast, he seems to be learning about and dealing with these issues, and I think we need to be charitable with our leaders as they learn and grow rather than taking comments out of context and spewing negativity. And Brian, I think that was the point that we were trying to take is let's try and look at this from all different sides instead of separating on the believer side to the left and, well, maybe considering Mormons, the believer side off to the very far right and the disaffected or ex-Mormon side off to the left. And okay, well, we have to only view it from this lens. No, I'm thinking like a 360-degree spherical object that we can look at it from all angles. And that's what we're trying to do.
So I guess this is the point where we bring on our guests here, Ryan McKnight and Ethan Dodge, to offer some of their remarks. But before we do that, just a caveat for our listeners that inviting on, because here's the deal, Brant, you and I both know that there's a demographic that we kind of, you know, go after for the show. And we don't want half of our listeners to unsubscribe to us simply because we allowed these guys to come on the show, right? We don't want that to happen. So let's just go ahead and qualify this up front here that inviting them on the show is not an endorsement of Mormon Leaks. Ryan McKnight and Ethan Dodge are two of the guys that are behind Mormon Leaks. And Ryan and Ethan recently started another organization together titled the Truth and Transparency Foundation. Incidentally, Ryan, Ethan, foundation is misspelled on your about section. So now I really don't know who to trust anymore.
Ooh, we're getting into it early, Brian.
Truth and Transparency Foundation exists as a parent organization of Mormon Leaks and Faith Leaks projects and aims to establish and promote guidelines and standards for religions and religious nonprofits to keep and avoid... to avoid deception and corruption and promote truth and transparency. That's just read right off of their website. Brant and I have been pretty clear in our criticisms of Mormon Leaks. We definitely don't see eye to eye when it comes to many of the issues that are surrounding the church, but we want to model what it's like to have civil adult conversations with those whom we might have disagreements, even if, you know, they're a couple of low-life, bottom-feeding, ambulance-chasing pond scum. I'm joking. Ryan and Ethan, welcome to the Mormon News Report.
Hey, guys.
He said that with so much enthusiasm.
Hey, well, that's not the worst thing that's ever been said about us, so I'll take it.
Well, actually, from what I understand, you've also been referred to as a deep secret insider for the church, right? Tell us that story.
The Mormon deep state.
Well, somebody who is a... Yeah, I mean, somebody who I guess I refer to him as a snufferite. I mean, somebody who follows sort of the Denver snuffer line of Mormonism. He made a claim in one of their private groups on Facebook that they shouldn't listen to me because I'm working for the church and the church is paying me to cause confusion and distraction while the 12 apostles are, you know, conniving to do some sort of evil things or something like that, you know. So Apparently I'm on the payroll.
So it's kind of like when Emperor Palpatine set up the whole Trade Federation scandal in order to really do what he wanted to do, which was to take over the Galactic Republic.
I've never seen those episodes of Star Wars, but I'll take your word for it.
Are you kidding me? Okay, this conversation's over right
now. That's exactly what it is. To a T.
Ryan's out like, I don't know. And Ethan's like, yep, totally got you, Brian. We're on this
page, buddy. See? Yeah, you can tell who the geek is of us too.
I love the original Star Wars movies. And when I was a senior in high school, episode one came out and I hated it. And I have never watched a Star Wars since then. There it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, fair enough.
Dude, you just dated yourself. Do you want to know what grade I was in when episode one came out?
What, third?
Were you even in a grade?
I think I was like in third grade.
Nice. So you see, this is the difference, is that it's all a matter of perspective. All of this stuff, right, is a matter of perspective, whether we're talking about religion or whether we're talking about the other true religion, which is Star Wars. It's a matter of perspective of when you grew up in it and the period of time that you're most familiar with. Ethan is most familiar with the prequels, therefore they're glorious and awesome. And the rest of us who grew up in the 80s and who saw the original say, no, this is a bunch of lies being spewed by the devil himself.
No, the prequels are terrible.
Well, okay.
For those of you keeping track at home, I think this is the third episode in a row where we've geeked out about Star Wars. So
got that going.
No, we did. No, that's not true, Brant. We did DC versus Marvel.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
All right. So listen.
So what's the real reason why we have these guys on, Brian?
We wanted to give you guys a chance to respond to Brant's big mouth. But before we do that, let me just throw you a bone, okay? I'm not going to mince words. What you guys do bothers me. But I sit here and I say, do I feel the same way about other whistleblowers and document leakers like, who's that guy? Edward Snowden. And if I don't feel the same way about him, if I think what Snowden doing is admirable, but I think what you guys are doing is repulsive, then maybe the problem is mine and not yours. Can I say that?
That's a refreshing thing fair. To hear, actually.
Yeah. Seems completely fair.
Yeah. I'm okay with you guys saying that you don't like it too. I mean, I get it. I expect Mormons to not like it. So,
yeah.
I mean, it doesn't bother me. I think usually when I interact with Mormons on this topic, my only request, which is usually not granted, is that the person on the other end of the conversation at least try to understand where we're coming from, and that there's more than one way to skin a cat in life. And I usually am not granted that consideration.
Right. Right. So, I think that, you know what, to be honest, I'd love to get together with the two of you, Brian and I, to get together with the two of you with the mics off and just go at it with this, but we've got a limited amount of time. And specifically, I want to get into your op-ed that was in the Tribune that we covered last week about gaslighting, because obviously you heard some of the feedback that we got, you heard our comments. So here's where I stand. And I'll just lay it all out on the table. And I think Brian's along the same lines. But Brian, if I'm misrepresenting, please let me know. But I think Brian and I both think that this word is becoming a trendy label within online and post-Mormonism. I think it's something that I understand why people are using it. I think that it legitimately does happen. But at the same time, I think my bigger concern is, it seems like, and I'll just be blunt, it seems like it's an easy label that elicits a highly emotional response that doesn't completely get into the nuances of things like leadership roulette and the way that people interpret different pieces of fact and history about Mormonism. So I'm just not comfortable with how it's being used, because it's being lobbed out there as a conversation ender and as a grenade that doesn't really have much follow-up, and there's no way you can do follow-up. So give me your perspective on why you guys are justified in using it, especially with regards to that Tribune piece.
Yeah, okay. Let me say a few things on that, and then Ethan can jump in and give his opinion, because he has a unique perspective on this that I don't necessarily have, okay? First of all, I want people to know, and this is not an apology for using the word, because we don't apologize for using the word, but people should understand that we did not write that headline, okay? And anybody who's been published before in a newspaper knows that while you can submit something with a headline, the editors have complete control to change it in whatever way they want. And in this case, it was not the headline that we wrote. I'm not saying I don't like the headline or that the headline is bad. I just want people to understand that was not our headline. Our original headline did have the word gaslight in it, but I thought it was more of a subtext as opposed to the actual headline. Now, as far as using the word and it being trendy, maybe it is trendy, maybe it's not, I don't know. This is the first time I've ever put something, my name to something with the word gaslight in it. I've never made a comment anywhere on the internet or an article using the word. It's not a word I personally use on a regular basis. I know it's a word used by ex-Mormons for years. Now, whether or not that's increased in the last year or so, I honestly have no idea. But even if it's true that in the last year there has been a notable uptick in the use of the word gaslighting, just as your one listener wrote you, I see that as having literally zero bearing on the validity of the point we were trying to make. I really don't even see how it even comes into play.
And to Ryan, I understand where you're going with that, but I'm looking at literally one of the first paragraphs in that piece, and the sentence is this quote, the quote that Ballard says about their being as transparent as they know how to be in telling the truth. This quote shows the narcissistic gaslighting tactics routinely employed by leaders of the Mormon Church. And I think that's the problem that I have is those are some bold and bombastic claims that you're saying it's routinely employed by leaders of the Mormon Church. And I'm sitting there going, hold on, like that is some incendiary language. And I'm sure, and to be honest, I'm sure there's probably a reason for that, because it is going to get people, it's going to get people interested in the piece. It's going to get people reading it. Frankly, it had people like me that got emotionally invested in, like, whoa, where are you going with this? But I don't know. There's a part of me that is reading that going, come on, that is taking it to a little bit of an extreme.
I couldn't disagree with you more. I understand your problem with saying it, and maybe you disagree with our conclusion that we submitted with that paragraph, but that's what should be debated, whether or not the gaslighting exists, not whether or not we can use the word. I mean, because it made it sound, look, this is what I heard when you guys were bashing on this sort of trendiness of the word. This is what I heard. I heard you guys saying that the mere use of the word gaslighting is a knock against the credibility of the person talking about it. And I reject that wholeheartedly. If we want to talk about whether or not what Ballard said, or whether or not it's pervasive, or how pervasive it is gaslighting in the church, let's have that debate, but let's not knock down someone's credibility just because we think the word is trendy.
So I don't disagree with you on that, actually. I think you're right to call us out on that perhaps part of the message that we were saying is, come on guys, let's stop using the term gaslighting, at least in this trendy sort of way. I don't think that either of us, Brant and I, are saying let's stop using it altogether, but okay. Let's not.
If you guys or your listeners think that we were using the word as a way to be bombastic or headline attention getting or whatever, it just is not true.
Okay.
It had literally zero to do with our collaboration in writing this op-ed. I don't know what else to say.
I appreciate your clarification on that. And I also agree with you that really what it comes down to is the bigger issue of whether or not this actually has been repetitively done by church leaders, as you're claiming. So it really does come back down to the claim of that you're making in the article. And that's probably where we're going to go around a few times and see eye to eye, and perhaps not see eye to eye in other areas, and all this kind of stuff. I wish that we had more time to get into that. And maybe we will be able to have you guys on for a follow-up or something like that. But I mean, before we let you guys go, do you feel like you've kind of clarified your stance on this, or do you want to, is there anything else that you want to say to us before we cut to our news?
I would like to just say one thing really quick, that your listener before made a really good point, and this is something that I feel like you guys hammered on in the last episode, was that that, you know, you guys said Ryan McKnight is not a psychologist, Ethan Dodge is not a psychologist, and why that is 100% true. We are not psychologists. I feel very comfortable with my accusation of saying gaslighting, and I also feel comfortable saying that it is routinely employed, because that is my lived experience. I was routinely gaslighted by leaders of the church, and I believe the general authorities routinely do it as well. Whether or not, and I know you guys disagree there, and we could talk about that point some other time. And now what I'm about to say is obviously anecdotal, and I would love to see some more formal research on this, but it is not rare. In fact, it is very common for ex-Mormons, when they leave the church, to go to therapy and be treated for gaslighting. That's very common.
Well, and I will say this, and I just want to make sure that my stance is explicitly clear. I am someone who does not, how do I phrase this? Gaslighting is something that definitely does happen, period, point blank, like full stop. I don't disagree with that at all. Gaslighting happens within the church, period, point blank, full stop. It does, because I've heard too many stories to say that it does not happen. I think that we might have a disagreement about the level of language that we're using in talking about how much it's used to go to the level of calling it routine. But I also can't sit there and say it doesn't happen, just like, and we're going to get into this when we get into the show. There's a story about a woman who was essentially gaslit and was told, no, you are not sexually abused. So we are going to get into that. I think that the it is so, one of the things that I'm learning in 2017 is the language that we use is so important. And so I will say this, and I know we need to wrap up with you guys, but A, I want to thank you guys both for coming on. I think it was important that we had this discussion. And Brian, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to volunteer both you and I for this. Next time I'm out in Utah, or the next time that we are, I'm out in the West region, me and you and Ethan and Ryan, we should all get together and we should go have some drinks. I will have some Mormon appropriate drinks, and let's have a rousing discussion about this issue. But I want to thank you guys for keeping it respectful. And I hope that we try to keep it respectful for you, because I think this is the most important thing that could happen within Mormonism right now, is people respectfully having discussions. I don't think it happens that much. So,
well, same for us. And, you know, we would be more than happy to come on whenever you guys will have us and talk about these things.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It seems like you guys are coming up in the news pretty regularly. So, you probably will be hearing more from us.
You guys actually made the news again this week with your leaked BYU document. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to get into that in a little bit. Probably trash talk you a little bit. But maybe our listeners want to weigh in too about what you're doing with Mormon leaks and leaking documents. So Ryan and Ethan, we appreciate you coming on and sharing your perspective. We might disagree, but reasonable people can disagree with each other and still act civil. And I hope that we tried to make you guys feel that.
All right, guys.
Thanks again, guys, for coming back. And we are going to get into the news, Brian, right?
Let's get into the news.
All right. So, Brian, let's start with a feel-good story this week. So we talked a lot last week about the Light the World campaign. We talked with Jake Black from the Missionary Department on the Light the World campaign. This is from the Deseret News. Introducing vending machines selling goats on Temple Square this Christmas. Yes, you heard me correctly. Brian, let's break down this headline. There are vending machines on Temple Square. I mean, that makes headlines in and of itself, right?
You gotta love this title.
I know. These vending machines are selling goats.
Goats.
To which I can only respond, only in Utah, right?
Right.
So Brian, I don't know what you think. I actually think this is probably one of the most unique and really interesting things that I've seen the church do in a long time. So let's get some of the basics out of the way. There are four machines offering different items for different charities. These are on Temple Square. As a matter of fact, I don't remember correctly, but I think one of them is at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. So one of the machines, care.org, has items such as a personal first aid kit for $10, you can get school shoes for $30, and life-saving medicine for $55. And if I understand correctly, basically you select from this machine. So let's say, oh, I want to buy some school shoes for someone. So you press in A3 and it says, okay, $30, and you put in a credit card and it will buy school shoes for someone. I think something drops, and so it gives you a memento or something, and then it'll actually print out a tax deductible receipt. The second machine, sponsored by the Utah Food Bank and iCare for Kids, offers small food items for $3, two glasses for $5, and even eye exams for $20. The third machine allows people to donate bottles of water, thanks to nonprofit organizations Water Aid and Water for People. And the fourth machine, they're all free in their cards with a scripture reference and idea for an act of service. So they wanted to go to New York City and other locations, but they were prevented this year due to licensing. And this is where the goat comes in. For $75, you can donate a goat to a family in a third world country this Christmas. For $25, you can pay for two chickens. And all you have to do is just take your money over there and it'll take care of the rest. So, Brian, I don't know what you think. I actually think this is a really cool thing, and I will totally give props and credit where credit is due, because it's something different and it's something that I kind of wish we had it in my area. I would love to take my family and say, okay, family, let's decide on something that we're going to do for someone else this Christmas and have it with a little gimmick on a machine.
Yeah. So I'm going to give just a couple of feedback. First of all, I think it's awesome. I think it's a really creative and inventive approach. I think the easier that we can make it for people to donate to global charities, local charities, the better it's going to be. I think there's a little bit of a feel good kind of reciprocity, I think is how you say that word, by seeing your money actually go to like this little thing and getting a receipt out and all stuff. It's like, I don't know, there's a lot of really cool stuff about it. Now, let me give you a few, comments of concern that I've heard from people that I've seen from people online and just discuss them.
Is this the Eeyore effect where, oh boy.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's so much Eeyore. It's more just concern of because there's always, I mean, there's positives and negatives about everything. We try to cover both. And I think it would be, I don't think it'd be good if we just said, this is all 100% awesome and great and move on to the next story. I think that we need to address some of the concerns that people have raised. And here's what they are. Number one, which I think is a weak concern. And number two, I think is actually a pretty good concern. Number one being, all of the money that goes into marketing these things and creating these vending machines and making this entire program operational and run, it could have been used also for charity, and it costs a lot of money to do this kind of stuff. And that kind of money should have been used for charity instead of making vending machines. I don't like that argument personally, because everything takes money, right? Everything costs money to organize, to create, to develop. And whether it's going to be handbills you hand out, whether it's going to be, whatever kind of machination that you try to put behind charity is going to cost money. So I say kudos to them for coming up with an inventive way that people can actually conveniently access. I think you actually get more charity out of it, right?
I think you're right. And I would also say this is a question that we've asked Jake Black, and this is a question that we've debated, which is the money that goes into a campaign like this, is it the best use of money, or would it be better elsewhere? So it's a question that I think that not only have we asked people who are in positions who could give us a response on it, but it's something that we're probably going to discuss more and more and more into the future.
Okay, so here's the second concern, and this one I think is actually more legitimate. It's when people come across stuff like this, put in their $35, buy a pair of shoes, and say, there, I'm done. Capitalism has solved world problems. Right? So these are the same people who might say, we don't need initiatives by the United Nations. We don't need international cooperative efforts to try to end world hunger. We certainly don't need to be raising our taxes to pay for any sort of humanitarian issues globally. All we need is vending machines, and you'll see the American spirit of charity go to work to solving the world's problems and solving the nation's problems.
I get you, but that's all right. Let me just throw it on the table, Brian. That's a really cynical way of viewing the world. I don't think you're wrong, but do you really think that there are that many people that go, all right, boom, check this off the list. I'm good. I don't need to worry about it.
I think that the core concern makes sense. The core concern is where capitalism has a route to helping global issues versus where it doesn't. And there's a lot to be said for market-based initiatives that go out to help the world. There's a lot to be said for that. I admire that. But there are also issues that are systemic, that are political in nature, that are not going to be solved with market-based solutions.
That's a fair point.
So I think that the root of that complaint has some validity. Now, when people blow it up into what we're saying, this caricature of the typical conservative who's just going to dump $35 for a goat and say, I've done everything that I need to do to solve global issues, I don't think there's a lot of people like that.
Fair point. So speaking of globalism and global initiatives and conservatives that'll dump $35 into a vending machine and think that they've solved world hunger, Brian, guess who's coming to town today? Oh, Mormon.
That's a really awkward transition, because quite frankly, I'm not even sure that he would dump $35 into a vending machine. President Trump is coming to Utah, and he's in today. I mean, as of the time of releasing this episode, he's in Utah today.
I can't stop laughing. Trump's the kind of guy that wouldn't put $35 in a vending machine. He'd go up to a charitable organization vending machine and reach in the coin return to see if there's any quarters there. Oh boy.
Oh, that's awful. That's I don't know. It's kind of true though. Anyway, so
the Trumper is coming to town, isn't he?
Well, yeah. And again, as of the release of this episode, it's today.
Yep. He's going to be there, and he's going to announce his decision to shrink the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase National Monuments. And this is going to be his first trip to Utah as president. He's also going to meet with leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Senator Orrin Hatch was the one who arranged the meeting, and it's scheduled to include a trip to Welfare Square, which is something that a lot of U.S. presidents have gone and seen. As a matter of fact, his spokesman, Matt Whitlock, said in the past, Senator Hatch has arranged similar visits for presidents and takes great pride in showcasing this iconic facility. So I know Mormons and Trump have this weird relationship, like they're basically frenemies. They're friends, but they're enemies, and they don't like each other. And aside from the National Monuments announcements, Brian, I kind of get this. And I understand, I understand why the LDS Church is going to be taking him on a tour of the welfare square. I understand why they would meet with him. I understand why he would do it as well. It's a thing. I don't have much more to say about it because it is what it is.
I think it's one of those respect for the offices thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, if Trump was not the president of the United States and he just happened to, you know, to be the talk show host still, or not the, you know, not the talk show host, but, you know, the
Apprentice
reality TV show star. Right. And he was coming into town. I don't think he'd be getting the red carpet rolled out and, you know, meeting the presidency of the church and things like that. I think it's only because of the office that he holds that they're doing it to respect the office. What I hope, Brant, is that they're going to have like some photo ops with him. And I hope that they're all going to have like that look on their face. Like, when is this going to end? That's what I hope. You saw the Pope Francis. You saw the Pope Francis picture, right?
That's what I was just thinking of. Pope Francis sitting there going, I'm on.
Yeah. how much longer do I need to stand next to this man? Right. Like, I just hope that, like, I don't know, whoever's going to be taking him on the tour, whether it's Eyring or Uchtdorf, I just hope they have that slightly perturbed look on their faces. That's what I hope. A boy can hope.
I'm thinking of that that meme that was going around when the transition was happening. So you had President-elect Trump shaking the hand of President Obama, and they both have these really awkward looks on their faces. And then the picture goes out to showcase who looks more uncomfortable: Donald Trump, Barack Obama, or the picture above them, George Washington.
That's yeah.
All right. So those were two lighter stories. It's kind of a lighter week. Oh, wait, no, it's not. This is from The Guardian. And I will say that everyone, this is, I would put this in required reading status, but I will say it's a hard story to read. Let me just read the introductory paragraph. When Carol was 8 years old, she was baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as the Mormon Church. But she refused to stand up in front of the congregation and bear her testimony, to make a declaration about how she knew that God, the Heavenly Father, loved her. Her father punished her by raping her.
Ouch.
This was such a hard article. But Brian, this was an article that I think it's an article that's going to make many Mormons uncomfortable because they talk a lot about this Me Too movement that's going on with allegations of politicians and big people in Hollywood and all kinds of people that are being accused of sexual assault. And I don't think it's a bad thing for people to read. I don't think that it is completely systemic within Mormonism, but sometimes we have to read these hard things just as a reminder that this stuff is out there. And I don't know what you think, but Brian, this is definitely required reading, and I would suggest everyone go out and read this article.
It's the kind of article that just hits you right in the gut, especially if you're a father with a daughter. Anytime that you're dealing with this kind of abuse and, you know, sexual abuse of children, it just makes me want to tear my hair out of my head. And, you know, but the article goes on to make a pretty good point about how the Me Too sensation, I guess you want to say, I don't know what the right word is for it, but how that has some unique connotations within the Mormon faith. And I would say that the same is true if you grew up Jewish or if you grew up Catholic, or, you know, it's not like it's just like, you know, unique into Mormonism when you're discussing this. But it is interesting to look at it from a Mormon angle.
And I totally agree with that. It there is an additional complexity when you view it within Mormonism for quite a few reasons. One of those reasons, and I know that it's been getting some airtime recently, the fact that girls and women, when there is a sin of a sexual nature, are going to be discussing behind closed doors with a male to discuss what's going on there. There are routinely going to be questions about those types of things. It happens. And I think it's required reading because I think everyone needs to read it and understand that sometimes all is not well in Zion. And if you lull yourself into this security that, oh, well, it's the bishop, there's no issues there, then sometimes it happens. And I would say on the whole, almost all the bishops that I've known have been good, honorable men, but it does happen. And so I don't think that we could put our head in the sand. So again,
that was exactly what I was going to say. We can't put our head in the sand and pretend that human nature doesn't play a factor in church leadership and in local leadership, right? And
but you have to make it clear. Like, I don't know, Brian, I don't think this is systemic. But it does happen, but it's not everybody, but it does happen because there is human nature in people and it happens, but it's not everyone. And I think that's probably the most difficult part for people is like, wait a minute, you're not saying that my lovable bishop is one of those dirtbag scum of the earth type people. No, I don't think so. I don't know. That's the problem. And it's so hard.
But listen, if 999,000 out of a million interviews with bishops are fine with no crossing over of lines or anything like that. But then there's the one. I think that we need to go after that one. And I think we need to do everything that we can in our power to make sure that doesn't happen, even if it's just one out of a million.
I'm totally with you. And I think that that's the reason why this is such an important article for everyone to read. So again, it's from The Guardian. It's written by Andrea Smarden, and it's called "For Mormon Women Saying #MeToo Presents a Particular Challenge." It was really, really good. Brian, I'm kind of a film nerd, and I love Sundance. I'd love to go out there and watch the film. But wouldn't you know it, there's going to be two Mormon films that are going to be featured this year at Sunstone in January. Sunstone. I'm talking Sunstone. Sundance. I don't think Sunstone is preparing any movies. Sundance is preparing any movies. So this is via Sean Means in the Salt Lake Tribune. Two documentaries set at the intersection of the gay community and Utah's Mormon-dominated culture will get big launches at the 2018 Sundance Film Festivals. The films Believer, about Mormon rock star Dan Reynolds of Imagine Dragons, and Quiet Heroes, profiling the only medical practice in Utah that would treat HIV and AIDS patients in the 1980s, will debut at the festival's documentaries premiere section, Sundance organizers announced on Wednesday. So, Brian, we talked a little bit about some of the stuff that's going on with Dan Reynolds and Imagine Dragons. Believer covers Reynolds' upbringing, his struggles with depression, and reconciling his faith with his support for the LGBTQ community. Rocker Tyler Glenn is also featured prominently in the documentary, with the film culminating in the LGBT Love Loud Festival held in August. I don't know about you. I'm completely in on that. That sounds like it's going to be an awesome documentary.
I went to the Love Loud Festival in August, so I'm going to be looking for the camera panning over and saying, "That's me! That's me right up there!"
I'm sure my wife is going to love it when I say, "All right, honey, we got to watch this because I got to see if Brian's in it." Oh, great.
Yeah, look, there he is, bobbing up and down to Imagine Dragons.
Wow, he dances like an old man. So here's the other one. Quiet Heroes is the other documentary. It's by Utah filmmaker Jenny McKenzie, Jared Ruga, and Amanda Stoddard, and they profile Kristen Reese and her longtime physician assistant, Maggie Snyder, who opened their practice to people who contracted HIV during the AIDS epidemics in the 1980s. And this sounds like another really interesting one, considering life in Utah during the 1980s. So two very interesting films that are two very interesting documentaries that are going to premiere. Again, Sundance is going to be January 18th through the 28th, and I would love to be out there for it. I'm not going to, so hopefully, who knows, maybe we could talk to some people, Brian, and get a screener for the Dan Reynolds one. That'd be really interesting. All right. Should we get into the big news this week?
Yeah, let's get into this BYU leaked document story.
Okay, so we mentioned it a little bit when we were talking with both Ryan and Ethan. Speaking of our friends on that one site, a crop of documents from BYU were leaked this week, with one of them involving admissions to the university. So this is from KUTV News. A document titled "New Freshman Index 2013 through 2014 shows that during that time, applicants to the university were scored on several factors to determine whether they'd be admitted to the school, and male applicants were given an extra point. The factors for scoring included GPA, ACT score, seminary recommendation, and extracurricular activities for a possible 100 points. That list also included special interest as a factor. Another section of the document defines special interest as, quote, add 1.0 points for male applicants. Special interest was given more weight than seminary recommendation or small school, which each had a weight of 0.75 points. During 2012, the leaked document shows the student population at BYU was 52% female and 47% male. When BYU spokeswoman Kari Jenkins was told about this and asked for comment, she said, "BYU has monitored the balance of male and female students who are admitted. This is a lawful practice under federal law for private institutions of undergraduate higher education. However, beginning in the spring of 2015, we stopped giving preference for either gender." Brian, this made a lot of news. And I will be honest, this was one of those things where when you just read the headline, you go, "Oh, no, that doesn't sound good." But you and I had some conversations this week, and I think that there's a little more here than we that might not be aware of, that people might not be aware of if they just read the headline.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a valid conversation to be had here about not just what's happening at BYU, but how universities in general operate in order to keep balance between male and female student bodies.
So, okay. So let's get into the 1.0 point for male applicants. On the surface, that sounds not so good. But I think it's really interesting to see that during 2012, the student population was 52% female and 47% male. Now, I don't know what BYU is doing as far as their quotas for demographics or anything like that. But still, you're talking about an imbalance at that point between females and males. And it would make sense if they said, okay, we want to start tipping that back towards a 50-50. And I don't know if anyone would be too upset about a 50-50 male to female population at BYU. And I know that not everyone's going to be happy with this. But even if that includes something like, well, we want to make sure that the right population is here to get the most people married, because that's what we're all about. So yeah, having an imbalance of 52-47, that's not going to help, because there's going to be more females than males. And by the way, we don't do polygamy anymore, so we can't really have that happening. So am I way off here, Brian?
So I think you actually stole my thunder, because I was going to say it really all comes down to the dating pool, right?
Yeah.
That's what this whole thing is about, is let's make sure that that we have the right proper number of male to female ratio. So no, I mean, I think obviously we're joking, guys. Don't write in on that and say, no, you guys are up in the air. That's not yet. No, we don't write in yet. But at the same time, there is some legitimacy. Again, going back to what the spokeswoman said, Carrie Jenkins. She said that this is a lawful practice under federal law for private institutions and undergraduate higher education in order to strike a balance between male and female students. And they do the same thing for ethnicity. They do the same thing for in-state versus out-of-state. They do the same thing for whether it's a student that's coming over from the Middle East. And, you know, they get a preferential number in order to try to increase those admissions. It's all about trying to increase admissions of certain demographics. You might not like it. That might not be the way that you wish that colleges would work. But let's face it, if they didn't have some sort of system in place, then we would be dealing with a lot of imbalances when it comes to higher education. And you have to ask yourself, is that more fair?
And Brian, let me say this. As someone who graduated 15 years ago, it was very, very well known, if you were from my part of the country, the Midwest, or basically east of the Mississippi, you graduated seminary, you checked off the typical Mormon boxes, right? You had a really good shot of getting into BYU. And to me, that makes sense. You want to tip it. You want to have certain demographics represented, and you want to be consistently tweaking with that formula or whatever to get the right demographics. I say that because would it be right for someone, and this is, might get me in trouble, would it be right for someone who lives deep in the heart of Utah County, where they have 7 stakes in their high school versus to get into BYU versus someone maybe from my neck of the woods who has 7 high schools in their state to go to a place like BYU? It just makes sense that you want to be consistently tweaking with that demographic. So
yeah, so I think, you know, so we've hashed out what if this is an ethical practice and universities that use this to try to, you know, to keep some sort of balance in their student demographics and whatnot. But I think the bigger issue here is whether or not this was even a newsworthy story to begin with, because I get the sense that, you know, you got Ryan and Ethan over there, and, you know, we just talked to them a little bit ago. So, and we warned them that when we talk about this topic, that we were probably going to throw them under the bus again a little bit. So here we go. It seems like almost they throw anything up against the wall to see what sticks, right? And it's like anything that can possibly make BYU embarrassed or make the church embarrassed, we're going to throw that up against the wall and see what sticks. And half this stuff, I was going to say half this crap, but you know, half this stuff.
But you're trying to be nice.
Seems to have a pretty rational explanation, like what we just did, right? Like if you take that one extra step to think it through, you say, oh yeah, well that makes sense. This is just something that universities do to try to, you know, keep a balanced student body. This is not scandalous news. This is not something that says, oh yeah, those Mormons and preferring males, that's what they do because they're a patriarchy. Ooh. No, get over it. All right. And I feel like every time they throw something out, it's with that intention of being like, look, here's how awful Mormonism is. Here's how awful BYU is, which is owned by the LDS Church, incidentally. And it just rubs me the wrong way. I think so. Anyway, that's, I think we're going to throw this out to our lovely listeners. What do you guys think? Do you guys think that some of this stuff is legitimate? Do you think that what they're doing by throwing everything out that crosses their paths, it seems like, is a legitimate and helpful way to try to make the church become more transparent? Or do you think that they're just throwing gasoline on the fire? And I'm not saying gaslighting. That's not, we're not going there again. But are they throwing gasoline on the fire? And is half the stuff that they throw out there stuff that actually has a pretty reasonable explanation, but they want to make us look like jerks? What do you think?
Let me tell you this. I am beaming like a proud father. That was a glorious rant. I actually had to turn the volume down on my headphones. I've never been more proud, and it's good to know that the ranting is rubbing off on someone else. No, I'm with you, and again, write us in. You can get us on email, mail@mormonnewsreport.com. Hit us up on Facebook. Look up the Mormon News Report or on Twitter @TheMormonNews, and we will be right back with Roseanne Benson. Have you ever been listening to an interview and get frustrated because just as they're getting to the good stuff, they end it? Are you the type of person who wants to be on the cutting edge of breaking Mormon news? Did your doctor recommend you increase your snark quotient every day as part of a well-balanced Mormon diet? Do you feel a moral imperative to support independent Mormon journalism and the Mormon News Report podcast? Then consider becoming a Patreon member to the Mormon News Report podcast. For just $1 or more per month, you can get access to our entire back catalog of Mormon News Report podcasts. Want to know what we thought of the 2017 October General Conference? It's in there. Want to know about that one Brant rant that had you scratching your head wondering, where is he going with this? It's in there too. As a Patreon subscriber to the Mormon News Report podcast, you also get a special podcast link to the Mormon News Report extended sessions where we roll up our sleeves and get intimate with our interview guests. And we always leave a choice insider nugget for your support. Your generous contribution helps us to produce the best in Mormon news with just a sprinkling of snark. So consider becoming a Mormon News Report Patreon subscriber today. Just go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com, and search for Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber today. We'd like to welcome onto the show Roseanne Benson. Roseanne was an adjunct professor of ancient scripture and church history and doctrine at Brigham Young University and has served as the assistant coach for the BYU swim and dive team. Roseanne, we're going to have some nerdy swimming talk. I was a swimmer in high school. She earned a BA in physical education with minors in history and biology from BYU, where she also holds an MS in exercise science and an MA in ancient Near Eastern studies, emphasizing religious education. We're talking with her today about her new book, Alexander Campbell and Joseph Smith, 19th Century Restorationist, recently co-published by BYU Press and ACU Press. Roseanne, it's great to have you on with us.
Thank you. I appreciate your inviting me. By the way, you forgot to mention that I do have a PhD also.
Oh, see, this is the problem when you start trying to get information from the internet. Not everything is accurate. What is your PhD in?
My PhD is in public health with an emphasis in nutrition.
Fascinating.
So I looked at eating disorders.
So, you know, I've got to ask because I'm seeing a lot of health related things on your resume and your background, but also a lot of heavy church related things too. Where did those things intersect, and where did you decide to go from a health and nutrition background over to doing research on LDS topics and things of that nature?
When my father passed away, I went home to Florida and was asked to teach institute, and I really began to enjoy it. And so I decided I wanted to pursue another degree because, you know, you can't have too many letters after your name. So that's when I did the degree in ancient Near Eastern studies.
Hmm.
So seminary was your gateway to the religious studies education.
Well, it was institute. Teaching institute. I was not teaching seminary there. I was teaching institute in the Tampa institute.
So what was that experience like? I'm always intrigued. So I, if you're not aware, I'm based out here in Detroit, Michigan. Brian's in Utah. And so my experience has been institute is very different in very parts of the country. For example, in our area where we have a YSA ward or branch, I think it's a ward, their institute group is very close because they're a tight group of friends because they have the same standards and things like that. Whereas I've heard sometimes in places like Utah, you get a mixed bag of all kinds of people that go there. What was the Institute like in Tampa, Florida?
It was great. We had a lot of college students at University of South Florida, and especially when I left to go back and get the degree, Mark Ellison became the new Institute Director. I was just kind of interim between him and the previous Institute Director, and the goal was to get enough students so that they could get their own building and, you know, have a mass of individuals, and they've accomplished that. And so the Institute is really, really strong. But we had a great class back then, and I enjoyed doing that, and I was surprised at how much I enjoyed preparing and learning. And just, you know, I had always gone to Institute after I graduated from BYU. I just, wherever I was living, I always attended Institute classes. And, you know, and I attended Alonzo Gaskell's Institute class at Stanford. And he made this offhand comment to me, "Roseanne, you know, you ought to be teaching Institute." And I never even thought about that. I'm like, well, I'm coaching swimming. I'm coaching college swimming. And anyway, it's just interesting how we make offhand comments and kind of put little ideas in people's heads. And then they, you know, come to fruition in ways that you never anticipated.
So was your master's in Near Eastern Studies, was that a thesis-based master's?
Yes.
And because of the depth of this study in this book, was this by chance your thesis subject?
No. I did something on the marriage of Adam and Eve.
Oh, no kidding. Mm-hmm. Reading through this book, I have to tell you, I felt like I was reading a master's thesis. I mean, and take that as a compliment. That's, you know.
That is a compliment, Brian. You need to preface it. That's a compliment.
So just to give you my background, I'm a book editor, and I edit LDS history books. And so for me, you know, going through this book, it reminded me of a lot of the submissions that we get from like postdoctoral type students. So good job on that.
Well, thank you. I would say, I've written two theses and one dissertation. And the mound of material and research that I had to pull together into something that was meaningful, it was much more difficult than any of the other major works that I've done. This was just a mound of research to try and organize. And so for me, much more difficult than those others, although those were good practices, this was not similar to any of those experiences with theses and dissertation.
So, Roseanne, I've got to ask, your thesis, or I'm sorry, your master's thesis was not on Alexander Campbell or Joseph Smith. So how did this even become a thought in your mind to examine both of these individuals? Where did that come from?
I was taking a class from Richard Bennett. It was a graduate class with the seminary teachers that were wanting to get a master's to move on and begin to teach Institute. And I had this wonderful church history class from Richard Bennett. And he'd begin the class some days with, you know, reading to us, you know, like a couple of paragraphs from some research. And he is such a master teacher, and he's has this wonderful way of crafting, you know, his writing. And I was just enthralled in the first 10, 15 minutes of class listening to him. And one of the topics that semester was we spent a day talking about Restorationism and about Alexander Campbell. And I was fascinated by this. And then we had to write a short paper at the end of the class. So this is what I wrote my paper on. And then he asked me, about a year later, he asked me to represent the department at a John Whitmer Society meeting. They were having a roundtable discussion on Restorationism, and they wanted me to represent, you know, the religion department. And I'm like, okay, you know. So I spent a lot of time thinking about it and writing a little more, and you know, went to that at the John Whitmer Society. I would say that it's kind of underwhelming to be part of this group of scholars. And when the Community of Christ guy got up and you know, had his 5 minutes, he kind of said they were moving away from, you know, the whole idea of restorationism. And that caused such a buzz that, you know, the rest of us down the line didn't have time to say much. But it was interesting being part of that. And that kind of kicked off the whole thing back about 2003, 2004.
So I've been a member of the John Whitmer Historical Association for a few years, and I've spoken at a couple of their conferences. And yeah, I'm familiar with, I can envision everything. Where was that conference held? Do you remember? Because usually they...
That particular conference was in Omaha, Nebraska. It was in 2004.
Very nice. And I know that they did used to publish a restoration journal that was a little bit more broad in its look out, you know, outside of just the Mormon concept of restoration. And they've since done away with that journal. It didn't have the funding, but they still have the John Whitmer Historical Association journal, which they try to at least incorporate restorationist history in there as well. Now, because I'm in the publishing business, I was super fascinated with the publishing arrangement for your book. It's co-published by both BYU Press and Abilene Christian University. Can you tell me how this came about?
Well, the idea of co-publishing actually came about when I did my first draft of a manuscript about 2008. Richard Holtzapfel was at the Religious Studies Center, and I approached him, and he got permission to talk to Texas Christian. We were in the same athletic conference. I thought, hey, maybe they'd be interested in doing something at BYU. And I had one individual that said yes with revisions, and another individual that was evidently more powerful that said no. And by that time, I sent it out to several different places, University of Illinois, University of Utah, and other places. And I was just getting, you know, a list of no's. And at that point, I just set the paper aside. I just set the whole manuscript aside. I already had a foreword written by Tom Albright from the Churches of Christ. I had a foreword by Robert Millett. And, you know, I just kind of set it aside. And I didn't do anything with it until 2013. And it was just interesting what happened in 2013. First, I got an email from Tom Albright out of the clear blue sky saying, Roseanne, where's your book? Then a couple weeks later, I get called into Richard Bennett's office. He's department chairman. And he says, Roseanne, Doug Foster from Abilene Christian University is going to be giving a presentation at the John Whitmer Society Spring Banquet on Restorationism. You need to go, and we'll fund you. And then I get a call from Noel Reynolds saying, Roseanne, I accidentally ordered two books. Mark Staker's book, Hearken All Ye People. So I get these three things, and he says, I have an extra copy, and you need to have it for your research on Alexander Campbell. And so it was like within a six-week period, I get pushed back into this. And when I went to the John Whitmer Society, I met Doug Foster, who's head of the Restoration Studies program at Abilene Christian. And we had this nice talk, and I got his email and you know, how I could get a hold of him. And I don't know, I just got back into thinking about this. I figured I better get going on this. And I applied for money to go visit him because I wanted to do face-to-face and tell him what I was doing and that I wanted Abilene Christian to co-publish it. And part of the reason was is that I didn't want it to be biased. I mean, you know how many people write about Joseph Smith or the church and they don't get things right because, you know, if they asked a Mormon about it, then somehow it would be biased. And I just figured if I was writing about Alexander Campbell, I wanted to do it right. And if I had, you know, him looking at it and giving me some feedback, I would do this as unbiased as I could. And so I went and proposed it, and he said, well, you know, come up, give us your manuscript. And from there, I flew to Nashville, Tennessee, and sat and looked at Alexander Campbell's actual journals. They were so kind to me at their historical society, the Disciples of Christ Historical Society. And I mean, I held his manuscripts, his journals, the originals, for about 3 days, and just read and looked at them. And, you know, you can imagine the ink is bleeding into the paper. It's very difficult, but I got enough that I could really do something with those. And then I went back to Utah and started writing. And, about a year later, I, you know, submitted some things to the Journal of Mormon History, and I sent a manuscript to Doug Foster to give me some feedback. And, you know, and it just kind of by 2014 started, you know, it was reinvigorated. I was reinvigorated.
Let me ask you, because we've talked a lot about Alexander Campbell. This is obviously a Mormon show. We've got the Mormon News Report in the title of the show. And so our listeners are going to be pretty familiar with a lot of the background on Joseph Smith. But I don't know if they're 100% familiar with everything that Alexander Campbell did. You mentioned his prolific writings. Could you give us a brief historical overview of who Alexander Campbell was and the movement that he started, just for some context behind this whole discussion?
Well, he was born in Ireland and came to the U.S. in 1809. And he's Protestant, comes from a seceder Presbyterian background. And he, his father and he kind of get on the same page about restoration. The original, going back to the original primitive Christian church, he sees all of the proliferation of Protestant sects, and they want to unite the Christian church because they can bring forth the millennium. They are so ecstatic about being in America, about the U.S. Constitution and the that it's primarily Protestant, and there's not all of the conflict between Catholics and Anglicans and everything else that they had had back home. And they believe that the millennium is imminent. And so they're into restoring Christianity to its pristine purity, as you see in the New Testament, particularly as described in the epistles of Paul. So that's who he is. It's just interesting. Most Mormons don't even know that there's another restoration movement, that we just know about us. And if you say the word Campbellite, like we all know that Sidney Rigdon was a Campbellite preacher. We have no idea what that means. We don't know that he is a follower of Alexander Campbell, and that all of these people in the Kirtland area, a huge majority of those that ended up joining the church so quickly, were followers of Alexander Campbell's restoration movement.
And that's the thing that always stood out to me was I was one of those, in full disclosure, prior to reading your book, I was one of those who kind of, well, yeah, it was he was a member of the Campbellites and there was a lot of them out there. And then they just became Mormon and everything was better. But you kept using the word restoration. And I think that it's very good for an LDS audience to hear that the restoration movement was not something that was solely started by Joseph Smith. It's something that Campbell and others were starting to go along with. But one of the things that was interesting to me about your book is, so we've laid forth some of the information that you need to know about Alexander Campbell. But in your book too, you also go into some significant detail behind Joseph Smith and the LDS movement. So the question I have for you is, who was the audience for this book? Is it Mormons, LDS people? Is it other denominations who might be interested that have connections to Alexander Campbell? Is it just a general non-Mormon audience? Who would you imagine is the key reader for this book?
All of the above.
Mm. That was an easy.
I hope that LDS will read it so that they understand that we're not the only restoration movement. I hope that those who come out of Alexander Campbell's movement, whether they're from the Church of Christ or the First Christian Churches or the actual Disciples of Christ, I hope they will read it. I hope non-LDS and non-Campbell people will read it. I hope historians will read it. It is designed for a broad audience to let them know that there were two restoration movements. I mean, if you really look at what Roger Fink did when he kind of categorized all of the restorationists, we're not even listed as restorationists. The only restoration movement that he talks about is Alexander Campbell's. Does not talk about Mormons. So to let people know that we're a restoration movement, obviously, somehow we're the only ones that know that. But we also are ignorant of the fact that Alexander Campbell had a huge restoration movement. It was much larger than ours in his lifetime. I mean, you look at the numbers of people in Nauvoo. It's about a population of 10,000, and they're not all LDS. Granted, not all of the Mormons are in Nauvoo, but that gives you a ballpark figure for how many of us there are. In his church, by the time he's got, by the time of his death, there are about 350,000, broadly estimated, of followers of Alexander Campbell. So much huger in his lifetime than we were.
Yeah, and a lot of people are familiar, well, some people who dig religious history, nerds like us, are familiar with like the Cane Ridge Revival meetings and kind of the charismatic meetings that were happening at the beginning of the Second Great Awakening, which Campbell and his partner for a time, Stone, were both part of, both led.
Now, wait a minute. Yeah. Hold on.
Please, correct me.
Well, Barton Stone is going to come out of Cane Ridge. That's his territory.
Right.
And it is enthusiastic driven, but it's restorationist. Alexander Campbell does not come out of revivals. He comes strictly out of the Enlightenment, and he is not enthusiastic driven at all. He does not believe in the extraordinary gifts of the Spirit. He does not believe in the extraordinary offices of the church. Those were things.
I appreciate that distinction.
Yeah, those were things in his mind that were used to create the Christian church back in the first century, and that we won't see those offices or the extraordinary gifts of the Spirit until Christ returns. And so what's fascinating is that he was willing to join with Barton Stone. And I think there's two things going on here. Barton Stone very definitely comes out of enthusiasm, but he's a restorationist and he's not adding additional scriptures. He's not having visions, those sorts of things. But he believes in the enthusiasm that he is seeing at, for instance, Cane Ridge. And by 1830, Alexander Campbell is looking for a larger audience. And he and Barton Stone have known about each other for several years. And at the end of 1830, they decide to unite their two groups. So Barton Stone is the Christian church and Alexander Campbell is the Disciples of Christ. And so you get the two mixed. Some of them stay together. Others of them eventually separate. But that was the driving force. Is Alexander Campbell needs a larger audience to promote the millennium. And he, is a post-millennialist. In other words, the millennium comes, we create the millennium, and Christ comes at the end of it.
Right.
So very different from Joseph Smith, who is a premillennialist. And, you know, by this time he's writing his Millennial Harbinger, and he wants to unite the Christian church. And I think rather than create, you know, another denomination, it's like, let's unite these two restoration movements, Barton Stone's and mine, and get a larger audience and keep trying to unite Christians so that we can create the millennium.
Great conversations, and totally appreciate some of the distinctions and clarifications, particularly, I mean, as I was reading through your book, the terms enlightenment enthusiasm versus enthusiasm were very clear, and in defining those and the different ideological platforms that they were built on. Now, I want to go back to a term that's probably more familiar to Latter-day Saints, and it's even in our Articles of Faith, the Sixth Article of Faith, where we talk about the restoration of the primitive church. And I think that's a lot of Latter-day Saints just talking on a real basic level, those who don't study American religious history, who aren't necessarily familiar with the Christian perfectionist movements or the millenarianists or the restorationists. We know this term primitive church, but I think there's a lot of Latter-day Saints who don't really know what that means. And I get the sense through your book that it might have meant pretty different things even to Alexander Campbell and Joseph Smith. So first define primitive church, and then maybe talk about some of the differences between these two views.
Well, when you talk about primitivism, you want to return to the original pristine church of the New Testament. Campbell is going to take his information, particularly from the writings of Paul, and model his church after that. Joseph Smith is looking for all of the offices, and he's going to include what Campbell is going to consider the extraordinary offices. So prophet, seer, and revelator, those kind of things are not part of Campbell's church. For him, it's pretty much a priest and a deacon, or a bishop, an elder are the terms that he's going to say. You need an elder and you need deacons, or a bishop, because he uses kind of bishop and elder synonymously. And those are the two key ones for him. And the rest of it, not so important. You don't need to have an evangelizer. You can have people call to that, but that's kind of a temporary sort of thing. It's not part of the Restoration Church. And so much simpler. If you noticed, one of the things that I emphasize is that Campbell is going to he's trying to downsize so that everybody can agree on a minimum sort of things. Whereas Joseph Smith, I mean, he's all over the place. Old Testament, New Testament, additional scriptures, Book of Mormon, Egyptian papyri. He's just expanding. And so his idea of the primitive church is different than Alexander Campbell's.
So, Roseanne, I've really enjoyed our discussion. We're just about out of time. Do you have a few minutes to stick around for a couple more questions?
Sure.
Alexander Campbell and Joseph Smith, 19th Century Restorationists, is available now through the Abilene Christian Press website. That's acupressbooks.com. The BYU Religious Studies Center, rsc.byu.edu, and at amazon.com. Thanks again for joining us, Roseanne, and we'll be right back.
So, Brant, we're a few days into it now, but Greg Cofer Books is running its annual 12 Days of Cofer Sales now through December 12th. This means that you can get great deals on Mormon history, biography, philosophy, theology, personal essay, scripture titles. They got science. They got political topics. You name it. Here's how this works. You have to follow Greg Cofer Books on Facebook or Twitter. What they do is each morning, they post a sale for that day with a link to the books that they're selling that day, along with a discount code, and you have to use that discount code during checkout in order to get the discounted prices. It's pretty easy. Just to let you know, orders over $50 qualify for free domestic shipping, and customers that are in the local Wasatch Front area can opt to pick up their orders directly from the offices in Sandy, Utah. So be sure to follow Greg Cofer Books at facebook.com/GKBooks or on Twitter at twitter.com/GKBooks to follow the 12 Days of Covert event.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by our friends at todayinmormonhistory.com. From 50 years ago this week, on November 30th, 1967, this was written by Mark Garth. Quote, "I asked the president to listen me out and see if I was foolish in what I was suggesting. He said he would be glad to listen, and I told him I had just returned from the Far East. This is about the only time I have left my desk for the 2.5 years I have been working for President David O. McKay. And in my mind, I tried to convince a plan where we could bring temple work to our people. I said cautiously to President McKay, quote, if you think I am out of bounds, I want you to tell me. But I am proposing to you now that the church obtain or build a ship sufficient in size to run the oceans, and we equip 1939 this ship as a temple. And we equip this ship as a temple ship, that we take the ship and outfit it as a temple, then take the ship into the ports and harbors where our people live. We could do this around the entire continent of South America, Europe, along the coast of China, Japan, Australia, and even Africa if we wanted to. I was sure the cost would not amount to any more than what the cost of some of our temples have been. After I explained to the president my thinking, he said to me, that is not foolish thinking, and I want you to pursue this thought and pursue the feasibility of it and make a report to me. He seemed to be greatly intrigued with the idea. He seemed to grasp it very quickly and thought it would be a good idea, so I'm going to pursue it a little further as fast as my time will allow. This was from the minutes of a meeting on November 30th, 1967, and it was included in the David O. McKay diary. If you want more information, check out Devery Anderson's The Develop of LDS Temple Worship, 1846 to 2000, a documentary history. Brian, that is an awesome little nugget.
All I'm saying is, Temple Cruise!
Could you imagine the buffet spread?
Hey, listen, before we close the show, you know what we forgot to do, Brant?
Well, we didn't say an opening prayer, I can tell you that.
Where's that charitics? No, last week's question. We totally blanked on last week's question. Can we talk about it real quick?
Sure. So what was the question?
So it was, if you could design a hashtag campaign for the church, what would it be? And you know, we got a few fun responses, so we got to read these things.
Okay, so Matthew Jalelian submitted hashtag charity never faileth. He wrote, we team up with the community nonprofits and other churches and do service projects for a month or two as quorums, auxiliary groups, and individual saints. That is an awesome, that is like a 10 out of 10 on my rating scale I was using with Jake Black.
Yeah, no, I think that was a really good, like, I could actually see that happening. Now, the next one was a little bit, snarky. Joseph Peterson submitted hashtag we're sorry, which we're like, okay, thanks.
Didn't Elder Oaks say a couple years back, we don't apologize? So maybe he's just saying, oh, we could apologize a little bit.
He could be, maybe he's riffing off of that. All right, fair enough. Joseph, if you want to clarify that, please do.
Matthew Kern submitted hashtag Project Zion, where members actually figure out what Zion means. Hint, it does not include nitpicking each other based on moralistic perfectionism. It's not bad. That's not bad. I give it about a 5, about a 6.
On the Jake Black rating scale. And then finally, John M. Shaw submitted hashtag family comes first, or why I don't do my calling.
10. It's a 10.
I like it. Well, we have one over on Twitter, too, that go ahead with that one.
Yeah, so we had a couple of them. Jenny Noonan Dye, I see you, Jenny, at formerly Fred, said, hashtag, we all have work, don't be a jerk, is what I heard. And I think that's a great hashtag. So,
I think I might make that one a bumper sticker.
Yeah.
And then, was it Anjanette believed in Santa? She said, hashtag, not all Mormons. And clarified that by saying, like, when some angry, hateful person is the news who happens to be LDS, then we could add that hashtag to show that some of us are decent folks. And, you know, it wouldn't be a church-sponsored one, obviously, but, well, just a joke that fell flat, as so many jokes do.
No, that's a solid one. That's a solid one. So, for example, if something's going on and something is document is leaked, we could say hashtag not all Mormons or something like that. I don't know. I might just be in a mood to, you know, poke a couple of people in the eye. And folks, that is our show. We'd like to once again thank Roseanne Benson for joining us. This show is brought to you by the Cultural Hall Podcast. Be sure to check out the rest of the shows available at theculturalhall.com. For example, if you want some interviews, there's some interviews over there. If you want some additional commentary on news, they've got articles of news. You can check that out. Plus, you've got the Mormon News Report podcast, your friends and buddies over here. Music for today's show was provided by Scott Holmes. Brian Whitney produced and edited today's show.
We'd also like to thank Ryan and Ethan for stopping by to give us a little bit of, hand back a little bit of the ribbing that we gave to them. Thought they were pretty good sports. Don't forget, the question this week is whether or not you think they're doing any good with their Mormon leaks, or whether you think they're just throwing gasoline on the fire. What are your thoughts? Send us a message at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. For those of you who've reviewed us on iTunes this week, we thank you, even the critical ones. So how many are we up to now, Brant?
I think we're at like 10 or 11. We're getting up there.
Yeah. So we've asked, we've got a target of 20, and that's when we'll stop bugging you. So for all of those who have written in, we appreciate it. For those of you who are sitting there thinking about pulling the trigger and writing about how much you adore us or how much you despise us, hopefully it's the former. Please pull that trigger this week. And also, for all those who support us on Patreon, we thank you. Your dollar a month helps us with bringing things like audio recording software, site hosting, with Brant's gambling addictions, that kind of stuff.
What? I'm supposed to say that out loud, Brian? Anyways, if you'd like to reach out to us directly, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. We will be back with more news next week. We'll have news. We'll have commentaries. We'll have interviews. We'll have a sprinkling of snark. Until then, we will talk to you again after a while.